Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started. So I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations, postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca. Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
Framing is a presentation of information. What's said and how it's said. Whose voice is heard, who's not. The thing that was so noticeable in my study of the coverage of the cultural heritage destruction in Artsakh and in Gaza was that invariably, in the corporate and legacy media reporting, values that were missing were human rights, humanitarianism, and oftentimes journalistic ethics.
That's Misha Girakulis, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Misha Girakulis on media framing of cultural destruction, Artsakh and Gaza. Artsakh, also known as Nagorno-Karabakh, is an historic Armenian area located in the Caucasus Mountains. In 2023, Azerbaijan invaded and ethnically cleansed the millennial-old Armenian population. The so-called civilized West look the other way. Looking away has been harder to do in Gaza because of the enormity of the Israeli attack and the sheer scale of death and destruction. The Israeli goal in Gaza and the Azerbaijani goal in Artsakh is cultural and physical erasure. Both Artsakh and Gaza are reported as though they're just happening in a vacuum. By not providing context and background, journalists are guilty of media malpractice. Our guest today is Misha Girakulis. She's a human rights journalist and critical media literacy expert. She's managing editor of Project Censored, the media watch and education organization. She's the author of Media Framing and the Destruction of Cultural Heritage, News Narratives about Artsakh and Gaza. She spoke in Teaneck, New Jersey in mid-September 2025. The moderators were Mark Mamigonian and Henry Terrio. And now, Misha Girakulis.
As an American of Armenian heritage, the events and after effects of the 1915 Armenian genocide are imprinted in my DNA. Stories conferred to me early in life instilled an acute awareness of matters of truth and justice, cultivated an affinity for those suffering displacement, dispossession, and marginalization, and set me on a path toward journalism, even though I didn't know it back then. Journalism, it said, provides history's first draft and is duty-bound to set the record straight, which made it all the more difficult to reconcile how or why the Armenian genocide went unacknowledged by much of the world for so many decades. News coverage of the Armenians has existed across a spectrum, from the early 20th century dispatches of the Armenian massacres in Ottoman Turkey to contemporary reporting on the indigenous Armenians in Artsakh. The Armenian enclave situated within Azerbaijan, I explain to people who don't know about the region, I call it Artsakh throughout the book rather than the more internationally known name, Nagorno-Karabakh. Similarly, media coverage of Palestinians in Gaza, the occupied territories in Israel, from the creation of the Israeli state to present day, differs by outlets and nations. Like the Armenians, Palestinians have undergone repeated waves of social exclusion, displacement, and homeland dispossession, owing to the settler colonial practices of occupying forces and imperialistic geopolitical goals. Armenians and Palestinians are among the largest and longest-running diasporas in the world, with more people living outside their respective homelands than within the borders. Both groups still experience the lingering impacts of the Ottoman Empire's rule over the region that we now consider Turkey, Armenia, Palestine, and Israel. So as I was thinking more about how to put this material together, I paid a visit to the Armenian Museum in Watertown. And I was standing in front of the collection of the French Armenian Legion. And my focus settled on a map of a battle in which the Armenian French Legion, the Armenian Legion, had been sent into Palestine by the French to liberate the Palestinians. And I was really struck by the shared history, by the fact that Armenians and Palestinians are indigenous to this part of the world that is just in perpetual conflict. And as I was standing there looking at this map, I thought of the words of a journalist who I've long admired, who has now passed away, Robert Fisk. He was a Middle East correspondent, British Middle East correspondent, who wrote, you know, prolifically on the Middle East, spent quite a lot of time there. So I'm just going to read this because I think it also helps set the stage. So Robert Fisk wrote in 2018 that the First World War was a time of promises and lies. The promises came first in 1916. The British told the Arabs they would have independence. In 1917, they told the Jews they could have a homeland. And the French told the survivors of the 1915 Armenian Genocide that they could return to liberate their homelands in eastern Turkey. Then came the betrayals. The British created an Arab legion to fight the Ottoman Turks for independence and a Jewish legion to fight the Ottoman Turks in Palestine. And the French created an Armenian Legion, an offshoot of the French Foreign Legion, to fight against the Ottoman Turks for Cilicia. The Arabs lost Palestine, Syria, and Lebanon. The Jews did not get all of Palestine. And the soldiers of the Armenian Legion, having helped to liberate Palestine, were abandoned amid the ashes of their own burnt cities. Among the indigenous peoples of the Middle East, the Armenians were the most traduced of all, since they recovered not a square inch of their land. To be a loser doesn't get you much purchase in the history books. To be a loser twice over turns you into a curio. We're talking basically about the media's role in the depiction of cultural heritage, but also its role in constructing history, or how states in particular use the media to construct history. This is just that quote that's attributed to Philip Graham from the Washington Post. It says, "News is a rough draft of history." The main questions that I thought about throughout the process of research were, how does media coverage of crises impact public opinion and outcome? Have human rights and or humanitarian standards and journalistic ethics informed reporting? And have the media responsibly informed the public on the rights violations? The concepts that came out of the study are actually applicable beyond the context of Artsakh and Gaza. Those concepts, which we'll get into a little more, are looking at news frames, looking at news values, the devices that determine newsworthiness, what makes the news. Why is this important? It's important because Our historical memory is at stake. The historical record is at stake. And the way news is constructed and presented has such a bearing on public opinion, on our values, on the decisions that we make, particularly at the voting ballot. And looking at the way cultural heritage is covered speaks indirectly to that formation of history. Media framing. Framing is a presentation of information, what's said and how it's said. If we think about a picture frame or a camera frame, there's what's inside that frame, and then there's everything that's outside of the frame. So we have to think about both things. In terms of what's in that frame, you know, we have to think about the language that's used, the tone. Is the voice passive or active? How is this information presented? Because it's always going to be presented at a particular slant or perspective. The news values that show up within the frame are what are determining or telling the public what's worthy of knowing. And then we think also about representation, who's included, whose voice is heard, who's not. This is something that journalism schools go over quite a lot. There are 8 conventional news values. These all play into what is considered newsworthy, what is thought about when constructing a news story. The thing that was so noticeable in my study of the coverage of the cultural heritage destruction in Artsakh and in Gaza was that invariably, especially in the corporate and legacy media reporting, values that were missing were human rights, humanitarianism, and oftentimes journalistic ethics. At the end of the study, one of the conclusions I came to is that these values should be included in reporting: human rights, humanitarianism, journalistic ethics. Cultural heritage. Why is cultural heritage so important? Because after World War II, when the nations of the world were coming together to say, never again, these horrible atrocities, we can't ever let this happen again, different organizations under the umbrella of the UN were being developed. UNESCO as one of them, the United Nations Educational Scientific Cultural Organization, realized that cultural heritage is an extension of basic human rights. It's how we know ourselves. It's how other people will come to know us. It's a form of self-power. It's a way of relating. It can be used as means for goodwill, creating deeper understanding among peoples who are different. And it's also a form of diplomacy. So cultural heritage is enshrined in Article 27 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and therefore protected, theoretically. I used certain lenses to do my analysis of the media coverage. One of them is a concept called critical media literacy. It goes beyond just basic media literacy, and it comes from critical pedagogies, namely the work of Paulo Freire, and it looks at media ownership, production, distribution, who's represented in the media. Critical media literacy examines the construction and presentation, very similar to what we were talking about with framing, as well as content and context of stories. I also use the lens of Orientalism, the work of Edward Said, obviously, which is this colonial dichotomy worldview that posits Western culture as superior over Eastern. And this is important because this shows up in the way media covered cultural heritage. These two lenses actually are quite similar when it comes down to the line of inquiry. And these are just questions that both ask. There are questions around power, around who's profiting from the story. These are questions about who is centered, who is silenced, who is missing. Is there anyone being harmed from the way a story is being told? Another form of analysis was looking at a story in something that comes out of reading literacy, which is mirror story and window stories. A mirror story, it's like a story that's held up in front of me. I can see myself in the story. It's very familiar. It often reinforces what I already know, what I already believe, the opinions that I already hold. And in a negative sense, it could be a negative, confirms a bias that I may already hold. A window story, by contrast, is something that's different. It's unfamiliar to me. It's a story that is showing me something that I don't already know. It could be challenging what I already know, what I believe, the opinions that I hold. The one problem or negative with a window story is it depends on who is doing the telling. If it is in the case of the material here, Gaza and Artsakh, if the story is being told by someone other than those persons, people who maybe are in the West and have never been to those places, then there's going to be a filter over that story. So these are just all things that I was thinking about that were informing my analysis. This is something that I share with students, the red flags to look for when consuming news, whether reading or watching a video, listening to a radio report. Some of the red flags are to look for missing context. Does a story explain historical or root causes of a conflict or problem? Does it illuminate potential geopolitical problems, geopolitical relationships, power dynamics? Is the story giving one side, and is that side just from an expert or a military official? Or is it offering multi-perspectivity by talking to people who are actually involved in the actual story? Does the story illuminate and include the story of people being harmed or affected by a situation, or is it just an outside view? Is the story being depicted as just too complex or too far away to be understood and therefore reducing its importance? Also, things to think about are questions of voice. Is it passive voice or active voice? Are there claims being made? Are those claims attributed to someone? If there's a perpetration happening, is it anonymous or is there attribution? Does the story generalize or downplay damage, like the situation with I was looking at the destruction of cultural heritage. So many stories that I came across were just sort of generalizing, downplaying the harm. Depicting cultural heritage destruction as just an unavoidable collateral damage in a conflict. Something else to look for is both sides' presentation when the situation is clearly unequal, the idea of false equivalence. Look for photos and headlines that are dramatic but don't have proper context. Another red flag is when very protracted situations such as Gaza or Palestine and Israel or Azerbaijan and Armenia are presented as just sort of, happening out of the blue, just one-off situations rather than there's this whole long history. Stories that are overly simplistic and just depict us versus them or good versus evil that's a red flag. The use of absolutist language, always and never. And another red flag is what the organization that I work for refers to as junk food news, just distractions, irrelevant. But another red flag is rhetorical device known as semantic infiltration. This is something that actually gained a lot of popularity during the Cold War. For example, pulled from a Reagan speech in reference to the Soviet Union, the media would repeat the phrase evil empire. And so this idea of semantic infiltration is the use of negative language by an opponent or even a perpetrator that seeps into the language of those telling the story, even if it's completely not in their best interest to use that sort of language. So these, I wanted to just show a few of the headlines of the stories that I analyzed just to kind of point out some of these red flags. And this is regarding Ojsok, and it says that there's been a blast, a depot blast, not attributing the fact that it was blown up by Azerbaijani forces. This is an example of a false equivalence. The Armenian and Azeri soldiers clash. They just clash. And one other, this is just to show the distraction. This was from Le Monde. And the article is about how Hollywood feels about Israel and Hamas. I'm not sure that that's important, that we need to know how Hollywood feels, but there it is. So fast forward, what I was finding in these studies of the media coverage in both cases, Artsakh and Gaza, similarities between Azerbaijan and Israel. Both have purposely created bipolarized societies. They have both minoritized and scapegoated particular ethnic groups, Armenians and Palestinians. Both nations depict a false image of an ethno-state, this pure Jewish state, a pure Azeri Turkish state. Each has used the media to help manufacture an enemy within. And they both have used the state, they've used their state control over the media and propaganda to further these ideas. In media terms, borrowing from the title of a classic book by Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky from 1988 is the idea of manufacturing consent. This is using propaganda and these other rhetorical devices in the media to create worthy and unworthy victims. Those victims of crimes and conflict, the victims who are losing their cultural heritage, who are, you know, those minoritized, scapegoated citizens are not worthy victims. A couple of examples of how each nation has used media and state-sponsored communications to further their depiction of their minoritized citizens. This, probably a lot of people in the audience has seen this. It was a commemorative stamp from 2020 that the Azerbaijani state created. It's a map. There's a man in a hazmat suit using some sort of insecticide to spray down Artsakh, furthering that image of the Armenians as, you know, the vermin, subhuman. Similarly, the Palestinians are often referred to as animals, dehumanized, considered a blight on the state. Ultimately, the findings of the media coverage of both of these situations reinforced and corroborated what we have already been reading for years from Dr. Bedros Demirtasyan, who's, I'm sure many of you know, is an extremely informed Middle East historian who did help me with the organization of this material. But what he's been finding for years is that the perpetrators in both of these situations, Azerbaijan and Israel, enjoy impunity. due in large part to the ongoing narrative that they are necessarily fighting an enemy within. Azerbaijan and Israel portray themselves as existentially threatened, which is their justification for breaching human rights standards and international law. The media reporting often frames these situations as just too complicated, just too far away to be understood by the average person, which has served to stall a humanitarian response. Any kind of action, humanitarian action, has been depicted oftentimes, not always, but often, as futile or just, too little, too late. And then those depictions feed into public apathy. When media reports are divorced from the historical context, from the geopolitics, when these situations are reported, as one-offs, as though they're just happening in a vacuum, not part of this protracted events, the public is not moved to respond. This, I bring up a book written by Ben Bagdikian, Armenian, obviously, and also a very respected media expert. He first wrote this book, The New Media Monopoly, in 1983. It was reissued and updated in 2004 and has just stood the test of time as being one of the most respected media critiques of our era. But he said, media power is political power. And it is. And I think that's just something to always hold in our minds when analyzing media, when reading or consuming any media. It doesn't have to be all negative, though, because I know what I've presented so far sounds negative. And actually, a different style of reporting can help bring about different outcomes. So there's the traditional content model reporting, which is, usually shorter, breaking news, it's happening quickly. It's very good at documenting things that are happening over a timeline, but it's often repetitive, kind of parroting one another, and it's published quickly. So it serves a purpose for sure. Then there's the impact model journalism. And journalism is a little different from reporting. Both have their place, but journalism tends to be longer form. It takes longer to do. It contextualizes timelines. Usually, almost always, actually involves an investigation. It involves analysis. It involves providing insightful commentary. And it does take more money and longer to publish. Oftentimes, it's done by independent outlets rather than the corporate press. Media, in the best of circumstances, is public service. It's a public good, and it can be a guide dog as much as it can be a watchdog. We think of media, oftentimes as the fourth estate, as providing a check and balance to our government, to governments around the world. There, I came away with four ways to help shift the direction of conventional reporting. One is really obvious. It's adhering to best practices. Serious journalists and reporters too, and really any media professional, abides by the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics. And it is an American code of ethics, but it's known and used around the world. There are four pillars. The first is to seek truth and report it. Second is to minimize harm. The third is to act independently. And the fourth is to be accountable and transparent with sources and with audiences. The second is to borrow from humanitarian journalism, which is including that human rights framework that just makes an assumption that all of humanity has worth. There are no worthy and unworthy, valuable, invaluable. Everyone is starting at the same level. Another way to change the reporting is to, I'm borrowing from a conflict reporter named Amanda.